Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top news of the past week. Well, if you've been following the news in space in the last week, you'll know that quite a few people are talking about the whole question of mining the asteroid belt. Wow! Is this something straight out of science fiction, or is there something really there to this rather harebrained idea of mining an asteroid? Well, we're going to talk about this because three billionaires have now come out and saying that, yes, they're going to put their mouth where their pocket is and perhaps fund missions which may eventually change the course of the human race. Well, we'll see about that. And speaking about outer space, some scientists are proposing that perhaps we're looking in the wrong place when we try to listen for signals from aliens in space. Perhaps what we should do is concentrate on our own moon, where there could be a moon base left over from a passing alien civilization. Well, with all this talk about space, let's now bring it back down to Earth, because some people fear that some of these technologies, like mining an asteroid belt, can be used to make a weapon. Now, you may think to yourself, well, how can you make a weapon out of these things? Well, with us today is Michael Moore. He's actually a writer for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and he's written a book called Twilight War, about the fact that, in some sense, war in outer space has already begun, at least at the testing level, with the United States, Russia, and China, all three nations fielding weapons that can be used to blast other people's satellites, literally blinding them in the opening seconds of a major war. Something to think about. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top news of the past week. The lead story today concerns a group of, well, billionaires. Two billionaires from Google, one billionaire from Microsoft, as well as James Cameron, who did the movies Terminator and also went down and filmed the Titanic and made the movie Titanic, and any number of very prominent astronauts have signed on to a project to mine the asteroid belt. Mining the heavens. It sounds preposterous. However, it's not as harebrained as you might think. First of all, NASA has pretty much given up on the manned space program. President Barack Obama canceled the space shuttle. He canceled the moon program. And he canceled the Mars program. There's really nothing much left. Private enterprise will pick it up, however. And here comes private enterprise, of all things, to the rescue. Now, remember that if billions of dollars are spent on this harebrained wild goose chase, at least you know that it's private money, not taxpayers' money that will be spent on this project. Now, remember that with NASA sort of giving up the manned space program, it means that we're not going to have anything to inspire young people. President Barack Obama has talked about creating a Sputnik moment to rejuvenate interest in science on the part of our youth. But how can you do that when he canceled Sputnik? That is, he canceled the manned space program. So how are we going to thrill the next generation of young people? Well, that's where this program comes into play. Now, first of all, asteroids are way out there in outer space. They exist between Mars and Jupiter in the asteroid belt. President Barack Obama himself has stated that perhaps we should not send astronauts to the moon or Mars, but an intermediate goal, perhaps on a passing asteroid. Well, that's where we could begin to cut down on a four-letter word that is the main problem dogging all these proposals. And that four-letter word is cost. It costs an awful lot of money to send anything into space. Just in near-Earth orbit, spinning around the Earth, it costs $10,000 a pound. Imagine your body made out of solid gold, and then you can begin to realize how expensive it is to put you into outer space. Imagine your body made out of solid gold just to spin around the Earth. It costs about $20 million to ride on the space station if you are a space tourist. In fact, one Microsoft billionaire went on the space station, and I actually interviewed him for Exploration, and I asked him what it cost. The media said 20 million. And he said, well, he's not at liberty to say, but that's the ballpark, he said. $20 million to hitchhike on the International Space Station if you are a private businessman. Now, if you just want to go into space and come back down, not orbit the Earth, that'll cost you $200,000. Spaceship Two, pioneered by Virgin Atlantic. Spaceship Two is designed to go 70 miles up, 70 miles down. The price tag is $200,000. Well, to go to the moon would cost maybe $100,000 a pound. To go to Mars, an asteroid, would cost perhaps $1 million a pound. So you can begin to understand the enormous cost involved. So what's the trick? How is it possible you can bring down costs? And what's the benefit? I mean, we have plenty of rock here, right here on the Earth. Do we really need to go to the asteroid belt? Well, one possibility is to let the asteroids come to you. I mean, these asteroids move around, of course. Meteors, most of them are asteroids which burn up in our atmosphere. Sometimes asteroids come very close to the Earth. They're about the size of an aircraft carrier, and they simply whiz right by the Earth between the Earth and the moon, and we don't even know about it because we never had the technology to detect these things. Well, now we do. Now we realize that, well, every few years, a gigantic asteroid comes lumbering by the Earth between the orbit of the Earth and the moon. So why not piggyback? Why not send a probe to reach out to this asteroid? Maybe even deflect it. This is where the cost comes in, to land on an asteroid and to deflect it so it goes into an orbit around the Earth. Then you can mine it at leisure. You don't have to go all the way past Mars to the asteroid belt where it could be dangerous. You can actually hitchhike on an asteroid as it comes through our system. For example, in the year 2029, the asteroid Apophis is about 1,000 feet across, about the size of the Rose Bowl. It will come whizzing right by the planet Earth. In fact, you'll probably even see it go right overhead if you have binoculars. Then in 2036, it makes another close pass of the Earth. Some people say, well, why not hitchhike a ride just to get our feet wet? Hitchhike a ride on an asteroid, land on Apophis, and simply take it out to the fringes of the solar system. After a while, we get good at it. We could put rockets on it and deflect the orbit. Then instead of orbiting the sun, this asteroid may orbit the Earth, and then we can mine it at will. So that's one way of vastly reducing the cost of a mission to outer space. Another possibility is to do it in steps. These people are not fools. They're billionaires. They're not going to throw their money to the wind. They say that the first step is to build private space telescopes. That right, private space telescopes. The Hubble Space Telescope, is, of course, manned by the government and NASA. This would be a private telescope, and private enterprise could then use this telescope to zero in on nearby asteroids, analyze their mineral content, their trajectories, and things like that. Then, once we do that, what's the payoff? What's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow? Well, here's where it gets fuzzy again. Some people say that there are platinum-like materials, metals on asteroids that could be mined, which would give us a bonanza. Well, maybe, maybe not. First of all, asteroids do land on the Earth. They're called meteorites. And we've analyzed them for the nickel, carbon, iron content. And yes, it is possible that they may have some exotic materials on them. But some people say that the real payoff is not to bring these things back to Earth. That's expensive. The real payoff is to use them in outer space. Use them to create space stations and space colonies in outer space. So why do we have to bring them back down to Earth? Why not simply keep them in outer space and use them as building blocks for space colonies? Well, at this point, things get really fuzzy because we're now talking 10, 20, 30 years into the future, and who knows what kinds of booster rockets we're going to have? Who knows what kinds of technologies will exist? And who knows whether even deep pockets will eventually come up empty? And also, speaking about news from outer space, some scientists are saying that the search for SETI, that is, intelligent life in outer space, listening in on radio signals, could be barking up the wrong tree. Maybe they're simply too far away. Maybe they're communicating with us on a different frequency. In other words, if you're an ant listening in on workers nearby building a 10-lane superhighway, would the ant even know the frequencies used by the workers when they were building this gigantic 10-lane superhighway? Would they even know what a 10-lane superhighway was? We could be the ants. We could be in a sector of the galaxy teeming with intelligent life, but we're too dumb. We're too primitive to listen in on the frequencies of the aliens. That's why some scientists are saying, well, instead of them coming to us with their signals, why don't we go to them? Well, of course, that's a big problem. We don't have the booster rockets, and it would take thousands and thousands of years for a Saturn rocket to reach the nearby stars. However, there is an idea that's been kicked around. Remember the movie 2001? In the movie 2001, the aliens came to us. We didn't go to them. In fact, they're already here. They're on our moon. And what do they do on our moon? Well, first, they listen to us. They monitor our progress. But what else they do is they make copies of themselves. These robots make copies of themselves, and they shoot out to land on other moons. And that's sort of like a virus. A virus is a molecule that can colonize trillions of cells in your body within about 2 weeks. How's that possible? How can one molecule conquer the human body? Well, it does that by landing on a cell, hijacking the machinery, sending out perhaps thousands of other viruses, and they in turn hijack the machinery of other cells, making another thousand-fold increase. So starting from one, you get 1,000. Starting with 1,000, you get 1,000,000. Then 1 billion, then 1 trillion. And just in a handful of generations, you're up to quadrillions of viruses circulating in your blood, and then you start to sneeze. That's called a cold. So some people are saying, why not take this idea seriously? A, maybe they're already on our moon. Maybe we don't have to go listening into the galaxy. Maybe they're already here on our own moon. And how long will it take before we can really figure out everything that's happening on the moon? It may take another 100 years. Some people say, well, then why don't we begin the process of sending these things out into outer space? They don't have to be big. They could be the size of pencil lead, the size of a paperclip. And we can send thousands, millions of them in outer space. They make a factory on the moon. They make carbon copies of themselves. They're very simple. They make carbon copies of themselves, and they shoot out to colonize thousands more moons in distant galaxies. Pretty soon, some of them may actually reach the nearby stars. Some of them may actually radio signals back from the nearby stars. Now, of course, we're still talking about centuries before this technology can be perfected, but it's a different way of approaching this whole question. Maybe we should reach out to them as well. Maybe instead of simply listening, which could be a waste of time, maybe we should try to seriously think of how Mother Nature uses tiny little molecules to colonize human bodies, giving us a cold, or, for that matter, how the exponential increase in robotic power can give us the technology by which we can make contact with intelligent life through the universe. Well, if it all sounds like science fiction, it probably is. Well, once again, in the next section of exploration, we're going to talk about the misuse of this technology. What happens if space is used for warfare? Our special guest, Michael Moore, will talk about a twilight war, a war that's secretly being conducted by the United States, Russia, and even China, in case warfare breaks out in outer space with satellites. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest today. We're very delighted to have with us Michael Moore. He is a former editor of the famous Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists,
He's a research fellow at the Independent Institute, and he's the author of an exciting new book called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. You know, last year, a lot of people were surprised and shocked when the Chinese blew up one of its own satellites with a killer satellite weapon. First of all, people were very critical of that test because it created thousands of pieces of space debris, and we already have too much space debris in outer space. Second of all, it was a weapon system that many people did not even know the Chinese were experimenting with. But the Chinese, in its defense, have stated the truth. And the truth is the fact that the United States and Russia have always been the leaders in a space war and killer satellite technology. And so the question that we're going to ask today is, what happens if war breaks out in outer space? Who are the winners? Who are the losers if war breaks out in the heavens? So once again, our special guest today is Michael Moore, author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. The first question for you is, how did you first get interested in peace and disarmament issues?
I've been interested in peace and disarmament issues all my adult life, and certainly after we had children, it became a more personal thing to me. I've always thought nuclear weapons were clearly immoral, and that goes back to the 1950s.
And tell us about your involvement with the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
Well, I became editor in 1991 and retired in 2000, and that was the end of the Cold War. Our circulation was slipping, and I told the board at my first board meeting we should be overjoyed that our circulation was slipping because that meant the nuclear threat was waning. But I got involved because I wanted to do whatever I could to ensure that nuclear weapons were never again used.
Okay. Now, most Americans don't know that there is a very fierce competition to dominate outer space. They heard about the Chinese test that took place several months ago, and many analysts were outraged that thousands of pieces of debris are now in orbit around the Earth as a consequence of the Chinese test. So first of all, tell us a little bit about the Chinese test.
Well, it was a test in January of last year. And they smashed an alien weather satellite, a Chinese weather satellite, with a so-called kinetic kill weapon, which means they just ran into it, smashed it into many, many thousands of pieces. It replicated a test in a rough kind of way that we conducted in 1985. The Chinese test is interesting because the Chinese have wanted us to, us meaning the United States and the rest of the world, to negotiate a new outer space treaty that would prevent any kind of conflict in space and weapons in space and space-related weapons on the ground and so on. And we have dismissed that. Every time the Chinese have brought it up, we have dismissed the idea. And I regard it as a shot across the bow. The Chinese were saying, if you intend to dominate space, we're going to challenge you. But the Chinese would rather negotiate a treaty.
Okay. Now let's say a few things about the past, because most people were caught flat-footed when the Chinese test took place, not realizing that there's a long history of this going all the way back to the beginning of the space age. So isn't it true that even with the launching of Sputnik back in 57, there were voices talking about a potential war in outer space?
Oh, absolutely. And President Eisenhower anticipated this kind of thing as early as 1955. And established a space for peaceful purposes policy for the United States because he did not want to see the Cold War extended into space. He thought that would be very dangerous. Then after Sputnik, a lot of people criticized Eisenhower for being flat-footed on this issue. Actually, he wasn't. But he was widely criticized. Even his own chief of staff of the Air Force, Thomas Dresser White, argued publicly in February of 1958 that control of space should be the goal of all Americans. But Eisenhower resisted that idea. He did not want to be the first president to militarize space. He did not want to see the Cold War go into space. And that policy was followed by Kennedy and Johnson and eventually became the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, an international treaty that is still in force.
But isn't it true that even during that period of time, the United States was in fact building killer satellite systems and in fact had an operational system based in the Pacific with Thor missiles that actually detonated hydrogen bombs in outer space?
It's true that the United States researched systems, and the Soviet Union was very aggressive when it came to space. The Soviet Union, until the Outer Space Treaty, was testing various systems. The Soviet Union was even talking about putting hydrogen bombs in space or in suborbital space. There were two different systems they were talking about, and the United States was reactive in that respect. We did have a Thor system with a hydrogen bomb warhead that was to be used as an anti-satellite system. But it was a very limited system. We could launch two Thors, which wouldn't have made any real difference. And then the system was activated, but in a very clumsy kind of way. It was clear to everybody that we didn't want to use it. Nobody really wanted to use it. Then later on, we did test nuclear weapons in space, and then one, the so-called Starfish Prime test, knocked out the electrical service in parts of Hawaii, and it killed a few satellites of other nations, and we realized that exploding nuclear weapons in space was not a good idea.
And isn't it true that Robert McNamara began to be a little bit skeptical about shooting hydrogen bombs in outer space because it would create an electromagnetic pulse? In fact, wasn't this the first time we've ever seen an electromagnetic pulse in action that could wipe out our own communication systems?
You're absolutely right. The electromagnetic pulse was perceived as very dangerous to our systems and to other kinds of systems, military and civilian.
And didn't Robert McNamara actually go ahead and try to deploy a anti-ballistic missile system called the Sprint, which never became fully operational and wasted billions of dollars?
He did. He was very skeptical of it. He was pushed into it by hardliners on the right, and it was viewed as a Chinese, anti-Chinese system. It was pretty well understood by then that we could not defeat a Soviet attack, but we believed that the Chinese would someday have missiles, and then the system would at least defeat a small Chinese attack. But it was only operational for a few months, and billions of dollars were spent. It was not popular with anybody except the aerospace industry and certain senators and congressmen.
Okay, so we went through the 60s and 70s, and then in the 80s, President Ronald Reagan changes the whole landscape by talking about Star Wars, and people were talking about Buck Rogers-type laser particle beam accelerators in outer space, zapping things from outer space. What happened to the original Buck Rogers schemes?
Well, the Ronald Reagan's Star Wars scheme was kind of fantastical. He was sold on it by Edward Teller and some other people, and it was viewed as an anti-ballistic missile system, and we would have ballistic missile systems in space. We would have battle stars in space and so on and so forth. It was a kind of a crazy thing. I have to say Ronald Reagan was far-reaching in one way. He believed that the MAD system of mutual destruction was literally mad. He wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons, and he believed that the Star Wars system would do that. Meanwhile, there were people on his staff and in his administration. He viewed it as a way of advancing space control. If we had anti-ballistic missile systems, we could also have anti-satellite systems, and we could control space. But it just wasn't technically possible then. It may be technically possible now to hit satellites from space. It still isn't possible to hit ballistic missiles, in my opinion.
Now, if you do, in fact, have a Star Wars shield, isn't that also a potential first strike weapon? President Richard Nixon used this analogy. Nixon said if you have two gladiators, the first gladiator strikes first, disarming most of the enemy's ability, and then you have a shield to absorb a weakened second strike from the second gladiator. So in some sense, this system is not only a defensive system, it's also an offensive first strike system, right?
You're right about that. almost any defensive system of that kind can be viewed as part of a first strike system. And that's very dangerous. It's unstable. And that's why a lot of military people actually oppose these kinds of systems because of the dangers of being viewed as a first strike system. The people who push it most ardently tend to be civilians, people who have never been in war, don't understand war, and who have hardline ideologies.
Okay, so in the 80s came the big disappointment that Ronald Reagan's great schemes violated the known laws of physics and the known laws of technology. However, in the 90s, isn't it true that the United States kept on going with a limited off-the-shelf Star Wars system, shooting a bullet with another bullet over the Pacific?
It's true that in the 90s we continued these systems. But mainly after the fall of the Soviet Union, a new paradigm emerged, which had the support of a lot of military people as well as hardline civilian people. It went like this. The Cold War had been very dangerous to both the United States and the Soviet Union. We should not permit another existential threat to the United States. Therefore, the way to do that was to be overwhelmingly militarily dominant on land, at sea, in the air, and in space. And I'm very concerned about the space end of that because the idea that space should be reserved for peaceful purposes is part of international law. But during the 90s, great progress was made in developing the doctrine for space control and even the hardware to exercise space control.
Okay, now take us to the present. Take us to the present in the sense of what are the capabilities of the United States, Russia, and China vis-a-vis space weapons? What's the state of the art today?
Well, the state of the art is this. The United States is many, 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 many years ahead of China and the United and Russia in terms of being able to control space with anti-satellite weapons. We are working on several techniques. The most important, really, is small robotic satellites that can be launched into space and seek and find and rendezvous with any satellite we want them to. And, of course, if you can rendezvous with another satellite, then you can do damaging things to it. We call these robotic satellites peaceful in that they could service future American satellites. But you can call that peaceful if you want. But if you can, come up to another satellite and service it, you can also destroy it or damage it. We're very far along in these programs. We're also working on a ground-based laser system that could damage or possibly even destroy satellites of other nations in space.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest is Mike Moore. He's the author of a new book called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. And Mike Moore is the former editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And also, you may want to pick up my latest book. It's called Physics of the Impossible, and it was on the New York Times bestseller list for 5 weeks in a row, and it was the number one science book in the country. And also, be sure to check out my website. It's www.mkaku.org. That's mkaku.org. So that's the website, www.mkaku.org. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Mike Moore, author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. Mr. Moore is a former editor of the famous Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. He's also a research fellow at the Independent Institute. And many people are unaware of the fact that there is a Twilight War. The fact that the United States and Russia have engaged in a cat-and-mouse game concerning the militarization of outer space. Space weapons, nuclear bombs detonated in outer space, H-bombs orbiting the Earth, these are all the nightmare scenarios of wargamers. But now China has been involved in the mix because the Chinese have shown that they too can blow one of their satellites right out of space. And so once again, our special guest today is Michael Moore, author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. Mr. Moore, wasn't there a Star Wars test, 10 years ago, where the space shuttle was supposed to intercept a laser beam from the planet Earth? However, they misread inches and meters. And as a consequence of that, the media picked up on it. Because we misread meters and inches, the space shuttle oriented itself toward outer space rather than toward the Earth, and as a consequence, the Star Wars test failed. But isn't it true, therefore, that we are using the space shuttle to test space weapons in the sense that we shoot lasers, very low-power lasers, at the space shuttle?
Well, I wouldn't call those weapons tests. We are researching lasers, and in fact, we illuminated a satellite in 1997 with a low-power laser. But we are working on the technology. But the main thing we're working on are these robotic small satellites, because they have the potential for doing almost anything we want to in space. They have the potential for hitting targets in low Earth orbit, which are just a few hundred miles above the Earth, or in higher orbits, many thousands of miles above the Earth. That's where the big threat is right now, and other countries understand this. They're very very keen on developing a treaty that would stop the development of such weapons.
Now, isn't it true that smaller nations like India, being outgunned and being overwhelmed by U.S. technology, have issued some dark threats that they may launch what is called a keg of nails? A keg of nails would be a barrel of nails with gunpowder inside, very low tech. You simply detonate it in outer space, and since most satellites are European and U.S. satellites, these nails then basically wipe out a good chunk of U.S. systems.
Well,
so that's
one of the ultimate nightmares in the space business. It's very easy to destroy a satellite, any kind of satellite of any size, by putting debris, pellets, gravel, nails, whatever, in the orbital path. And then that idea has been around for at least 40 years. And it's a terrible thing. If you do that, and if you do several of those, you could drain the space almost forever.
Now, the question is, who would suffer the most if there is a showdown in outer space? The Chinese have an expression, never pick up a rock, only to drop it on your own feet. Now that the United States is reaching for superiority in outer space, the question is, will it drop it on its own feet? So who would suffer the most if war breaks out in space?
Well, you're getting to the heart of an important issue, a dispute between a lot of high-level military people, mainly in the Air Force, and civilian hardliners. High-level military people in the Air Force tend to argue we have the most to lose, meaning the United States. About 850 active satellites are in orbit, and about half of those, a little bit more than half, are American. So if we ever had a conflict in space, we would stand the risk of losing many, many, many of our own satellites. So the argument, and I've heard this from colonels and generals, the argument is, why are we being so belligerent in our space policy? Why are we using rhetoric and developing hardware that might start another arms race? Because if the arms race ever turns into a conflict, we do have a lot to lose.
Now, if you have two gunfighters about to shoot it out at OK Corral, and one gunfighter grabs sand and throw sand in the enemy's eyes, blinding the enemy. That's like space war, in which case the blinded gunfighter then shoots randomly in all directions. So if it does come to space war, not only do we have all the space debris in outer space, but won't the blinded enemies basically fire randomly and create even more havoc?
Well, that's another important argument. War games have borne this out, that if we play a war game, and if we, as you put it, blind the other side by damaging their satellite, there's going to be retaliation. It's going to be much more random than it would have been otherwise. It's a very dangerous business to take out the other nation's satellite. I have to emphasize that a lot of military people are really against this aggressive space policy we're talking about. There's a real split here between hardliners, neoconservatives, triumphalists on the one side, and fairly sober military people on the other side.
Now, Vladimir Putin has basically gone ballistic over the Star Wars anti-missile system being based in Eastern Europe, even though the United States has tried to reassure it that it's basically to be used against Iran and, quote, rogue nations. The Russians are fuming that it's basically in their sphere of influence. So tell us what's happening now in Europe.
Well, you know, we are talking about having two facilities in Europe, and the Russians are very unhappy about that, because it would be a little bit like the Russians putting a couple of systems into Canada. I mean, it's right on their doorstep, as Canada is on ours. And if you put facilities on their doorstep, who's to say that 10 years from now that we won't use them in other ways as coercive tools against Moscow? It's a very ambiguous situation. Countries or national leaders look at the intentions of other countries, but they mainly look at capabilities. Intentions can change, but capabilities do not change so easily. And if one country has a lot of power in one area, they may say, we will not use it now, but 10 years from now, the intentions may change, and the Russians are very conscious of that.
And Putin even raised the stakes last year when he put his weapons basically on alert status and threatened Europe with nuclear retaliation. So this is really upping the stakes, right? And while in the United States there's almost no publicity around this, the Russians are fuming.
But they're fuming, but this alert business is rhetorical. Both countries, both the United States and Russia, have weapons on alert, and they say they're detargeted, but it's just a matter of, it would take a matter of minutes to retarget them. It's done for rhetorical effect. It's not a strategic change, in my opinion.
Now let's talk about China. If you read the Chinese concerns, first of all, they believe that a Star Wars system would decouple Taiwan away from mainland China. And China has said, more or less, that there's only one scenario in which they would unleash the power of their military, and that is over Taiwan. So isn't the United States touching very sensitive areas when there is a possible decoupling of Taiwan from China, in which case China has already stated that it will go to war?
Well, the Chinese-Taiwan situation, I think, has been handled very clumsily in this country. You're quite right. The Chinese will not tolerate a true independence move by Taiwan. On the other hand, the Taiwanese tend to act very independently in many areas, and we have sold them weapons for years and years and years. It's always a tense situation. And the space assets used for military purposes have accentuated this. One of the favorite war games being played in the military over here is, what if the Chinese launch a surprise attack against satellites, which are, in effect, surveilling China and Taiwan? What if they blind us? What do we do then? And this is kind of a silly scenario. The Chinese have no interest in taking on the United States militarily. They make goods for the United States. They make goods for the Western world, and they need those jobs. Meanwhile, we need the Chinese. The Chinese are buying roughly $200 billion worth of treasury notes and bonds every year. That keeps our interest rates low. We're in bed together financially, economically, so why would there be a military challenge from China? Why can't we cooperate? We're in a new century. I think the old Cold War paradigms don't work anymore.
Now, it's been noted that even a limited Star Wars shield might conceivably be affected not against 1,000 missiles, but against 20 missiles. And it's also been pointed out that the Chinese have approximately 20 missiles that might be able to reach California. Now, given the mathematics of the fact that even a limited Star Wars system might be affected against a full-scale Chinese attack on California, isn't that concern on the part of the Chinese?
It's been a concern since the 70s. Our limited, so-called limited missile defense system proposed in the 70s was advertised by McNamara as an anti-Chinese system. And war games today still look at the Chinese threat, I put threat in quotation marks, and in the anti-ballistic missile system, which we advertise as being aimed at North Korea and Iran, is viewed by very many military people and hardliners as an anti-Chinese system, as a way of hedging our bets against the so-called Chinese threat. The Chinese understand this perfectly well. Everybody in the military space business understands that it well, too. Our anti-ballistic missile system is not aimed at North Korea or Iran. It's aimed at China.
And let's say a few things about Iran. It was just announced yesterday that Israel, senior officials in Israel, have just announced that it appears as if an attack on Iran is inevitable. So some people say, in defense of a Star Wars-type shield and Star Wars-type funding, they say that warfare in the future will be waged from outer space, like the Persian Gulf War. Most of that was actually waged from the air rather than from the ground. So what do you say to those people who say that in order to defend Israel or in other regional conflicts, we have to dominate space?
Well, I say to those people that it's fantastical that aggressive moves in space are more likely to start a war than to prevent a war, more likely to start an arms race than to prevent an arms race. I believe in this century the way forward is simply to sit down and talk and see if we can negotiate a treaty that would prevent any nation from dominating space or having the capability to control space. In fact, since 1981, delegates to the UN have voted every year since 1981 to ask the Conference on Disarmament to sit down and draft a space treaty, a new space treaty, that would prevent an arms race in space. Every year they vote for that, and every year the United States blocks any such discussions at the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva. If we're a nation based on the rule of law, and I think we are, certainly one of our major founding values, I think we have to say we're acting in a lawless manner there. If every country in the world says they want a new treaty, we should not block it. We should at least sit down and talk. It might not be possible to negotiate a new treaty. It might be more difficult than other countries think, but we're not going to know until we sit down and talk seriously.
Okay, well, we'll talk about a positive program in a second, but first, let's talk about a worst-case scenario. And, of course, this is science fiction. We are talking about a worst-case scenario, not the most logical scenario. But some people have pointed out that because of the oil crisis, the big nations of the earth will be grabbing for as much oil as they can around the world, including resources like metals. Commodity prices are skyrocketing as a consequence of the industrialization of China. And some people predict some kind of collision to take place, in which case, just like two animals that are squaring off, they bare their fangs. And sometimes a miscalculation takes place. So let's say it does go to a conflict in outer space, not anytime soon, but let's say in 20 years. At that point, 20 years from now, when space weapons are much more developed than they are now, what will be the consequences? For example, how much debris will be created in outer space? Can you win such a war? What will a maximum war look like?
Well, when you say it's the worst-case scenario, it truly is. And what it would look like, basically, would be that other countries would smash satellites with kinetic kill weapons. We might not smash satellites. We might use other methods of damaging or destroying up with a lot of debris in space, in low Earth orbit space. And if you do that, you're likely to render space useless for any purpose for many hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. If you create a lot of debris in space, and already we have nearly 18,000 pieces bigger than my fist circling the Earth, and those are big enough to destroy any satellite, including the space station. If you create enough debris in low Earth orbit, you make space unusable. That means you can't replace communication satellites and global positioning satellites and weather satellites as they wear out. And the global economic system would collapse. We'd go back to a 1950s-style economy. But now we have 6.5 billion people in the world. We can't support 6.5 billion people in the world with a 1950s economy. You're going to have resource wars. You're going to have malnutrition. You're going to have starvation. It'll be a massive, massive calamity for humankind.
So in other words, you're saying that there really are no winners if there's an all-out war in outer space and all hell breaks loose and we have thousands and thousands of pieces of debris ending the space program.
Absolutely. There would be no winners, and the planet would be the huge loser. I tend to be a fairly conservative person. And part of my conservation idea is that we should conserve natural resources, including space. Space is a huge natural resource, and we cannot damage it to the point where we can't use it anymore.
Okay, now let's talk about a positive program. There was the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. Many people think it's out of date. I've seen some editorials by the right wing saying that, of course, we're going to violate it. After 2020, in fact, there could be a traffic jam on the moon. The Chinese will probably beat the United States to the moon. Even NASA officials now acknowledge that fact when we go back to the moon in 2020. And if we have a traffic jam on the moon, it means that people are going to be planting flags on the moon, saying we want this territory, that territory. So it's going to be a mess. So some people say now, not 2020, but now is the time to sign a treaty. What would a treaty look like?
Well, the first thing that has to be done is you have to have a president in office who is willing to say to his diplomatic corps, we're going to talk about a new treaty and talk about it seriously. We haven't had a president. Ronald Reagan didn't do that, and H.W. Bush didn't do it. Bill Clinton didn't do it, even though he's a Democrat, and certainly George Bush II hasn't done it. We need a president who says, let's get serious, let's sit down at the table and see if we can begin working this out. As for what a treaty would look like, it would prevent any space-related weapons, weapons in space, weapons on Earth that can be launched into space. It would have to be fully verifiable, which would mean inspections in space and inspections on the ground before you launch, and inspections by robotic satellites after a satellite is in orbit. You would have to have an international system capable of tracking all satellites from the time they're launched to the time they die. We're not talking about a huge technological challenge here. We're talking about something that could be done for a fraction of the cost of the war in Iraq.
And what about claims on the moon? Many nations have now said they're going to put people on their moon, their people on the moon. What about what happens when territoriality disputes break out over the moon?
Well, I think that's a possible future scenario, but I don't think it's likely. There isn't much to worry about in anything remotely in the near future. Maybe 50, 100 years from now, we might have to confront that issue more positively, but the current Outer Space Treaty, 1967, takes care of that. There isn't much advantage. There's no advantage at all to having a military base on the moon. And so far as mining the moon for resources, that would have to be, if we ever do that, it would have to be managed by an international body. I think that's a second or third order issue. The main thing is let's negotiate a treaty that would prevent a conflict in space, because if we don't do that, and if there is a conflict, we're not going to be able to get to the moon or Mars or anywhere else.
Now, some people say that the Outer Space Treaty already does that. What are your thoughts about those people who say that we already have a treaty?
Well, we have a treaty insofar as weapons are concerned. It prohibits any military activities on the moon, has four orbital space, which is between the Earth and the Moon. It only prevents weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. It does not say anything about conventional weapons, new precision weapons. And that's what we're talking about today. We're not talking about nuclear weapons in space. We're talking about so-called precision weapons in space, weapons that could be called down from space and hit a very precise target, or weapons that can be launched into space to damage or destroy another satellite.
What about people who say that such a treaty would infringe on research, legitimate research like laser transmission in outer space, and so you would throw the baby out with the bathwater?
Oh, I think that's a red herring. I think it's time for the nations of the world to regard space as a resource for all humankind. That's what the Outer Space Treaty says. And you can conduct a lot of research, scientific research, by jointly with other nations and under international supervision. I don't think it would end any research possibilities. Whether or not we would commercialize space, that's a matter for discussion, and it would be a very difficult discussion. But I regard it as separate from the military use of space.
What about the use of nuclear propulsion systems in outer space and advanced propulsions in outer space, which could also be used to propel weapons in space?
Well, I think that's a bad idea. I don't think we ought to go down that route, and there are some people who think we do, but there's no immediate threat of that. Again, the immediate threat is our robotic satellites that can destroy the satellites of other nations. We need to take care of these first-order things first.
What about the whole question of nuclear power packs in outer space?
Well, that's a controversial issue, and you well know that working on the Cassini project and all that, and I'm not able to really comment on that very thoroughly because I'm not completely up to date on these little nuclear generators. But again, I am focused on one issue, and that's to keep space free of weapons and to prevent space-related weapons being developed.
And any parting thoughts for those people who may want to pick up a copy of your book, Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance?
Well, my parting thought is simply one I've already stated, that space is a resource for all humankind, and we should treat it properly. And that means we should not have a conflict in space. That means we should not have weapons in space. That means we should not have weapons on Earth that can target weapons or satellites in space.
And that concludes our interview with Mike Moore. He's a former editor of the famous Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. He's currently a research fellow at the Independent Institute. And the book is called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. And we should also point out that the late Arthur C. Clarke, who, of course, was the author of the book 2001, A Space Odyssey, which was made into a movie, he said, quote, "This book is riveting and disturbing," unquote, about the potential for warfare in outer space. And we should also mention, by the way, one thing that we didn't discuss earlier, and that is the question of nuclear propulsion systems like the nuclear rocket. NASA is already looking at the possibility of developing a nuclear rocket to place people on the planet Mars. Well, some people have said that the nuclear rocket is not so bad because it would use ordinary chemical booster rockets to get into outer space. And then once it's in orbit around the Earth, then it would then turn on its nuclear reactor and then use the nuclear reactor to boil off hot gases, which would then shoot out the exhaust, and it would cut the time to go to the planet Mars. Well, in principle, a nuclear rocket might work, but in practice, it's been pretty much a failure. The nuclear rocket was experimented with back in the 1950s and 60s. There was, in fact, a famous rocket called the Kiwi. The Kiwi is the flightless bird of Australia. And just like the flightless bird, this nuclear engine was placed on a railroad track. Well, the problem with the Kiwi and different kinds of nuclear booster rockets was the fact that they were unstable. Many times they melted down, And in fact, out of sheer frustration, when the project was finally canceled, engineers removed the control rods of the nuclear rocket and basically let it explode like a small nuclear bomb. In fact, the detonation of the nuclear rocket was actually photographed, and the tape is commercially available. Now, the Russians heard about this, and the Russians were quite angry and said that this is a violation of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, because it was, in fact, a nuclear detonation. And there's a lesson here, and that is that even though the nuclear rocket may appear to be peaceful, even though the nuclear rocket is made critical when it's in orbit, in fact, it can detonate like a small nuclear device, and in fact, things can go wrong. You can imagine a scenario where we have a crippled nuclear reactor orbiting the planet Earth that's turned on, and yet we've lost communications with it, and it's like a nuclear bomb orbiting the planet Earth. So personally, I think it's not a good idea if we nuclearize outer space with gigantic reactors and nuclear rockets, even though they are, quote, for peaceful purposes, unquote. Time and time again, we see an example of where space is not a Sunday picnic, and what can go wrong will go wrong. And so we have the nightmare scenario of a nuclear reactor orbiting the planet Earth like a time bomb, and who knows where it's going to land. We've had similar situations where satellites have tumbled out of orbit only to land on people's backyards. What happens when a nuclear reactor or a nuclear booster rocket tumbles out of orbit and lands on the planet Earth? It could be a catastrophe beyond imagination because of the large quantities of nuclear materials that are stored in a nuclear power plant, much more than found in a nuclear power pack like plutonium. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics, inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And also be sure to check out my latest book. It's called Physics of the Impossible. And my website is www.mkaku.org. That's www.mkaku.org. That's the website for Exploration. Good day.